What's happening, y'all? This is Todd Wilson with another episode of Elevate Your Game, brought to you by our sponsor, Brand Scene. Shout out to my guy, Max Hazard. If you guys didn't know, sorry, I was hooping. He has the hats, he has the shirts, he has the shorts. Go out, make sure you guys support. Today, we have a special guest who's a husband, a father, runs his own company. I'm not gonna say the name because I wanna say all his titles. Runs his own basketball development company and a co-founder of ABA Academy down in Orange County, Mr. Shay Frazee.
Yep, good to see you, Todd. Yeah. Thanks for having me out here, brother.
Absolutely, man. It's been a long time coming.
We've been missing a few times. Busy time of year right now.
Absolutely.
The summer basketball in Southern California is the best, but it is busy.
Absolutely, just working hard, hard, man. So
all the time.
We love to start this show off with your favorite hoop movie of all time and why.
Yeah, I was a little bit nervous when you said we were starting with that because I'm not a big basketball movie guy. I mean, I've seen a few of them, He Got Game. But my favorite, I think the one I watched the most too when I was younger was Rebound. You know that one?
Oh, yeah, with Martin Lawrence.
The Earl Manigault.
Oh, the original Rebound.
Yeah, with Don Cheadle. Don Cheadle, Earl Manigault story. My dad was pretty old for being my dad. Yeah, I mean, he's like 53 or something. So he knew all those old, you know, like the Connie Hawkins, Earl Manigault, like legends of street ball with like the lore, but there was no social media. There wasn't YouTube. There was nothing except for the oral history of street basketball.
Yep.
So he told me about Earl Manigault, and then I saw that movie at Blockbuster and rented it and watched it quite a few times.
Oh, I think I've only seen it once, and I barely remember it.
It's heavy. He's shooting himself in the leg, and you're like, dang, this is going down a bad direction. But it was a good story, you know, high drama. It was fun to watch.
Man, that's a poster we have to get. I don't think we have that poster. We have the second Rebound with Martin Lawrence, and he's coaching kids. Different story.
There you go. Yeah, very different story. That one's much lighter. Not as serious.
Absolutely. So when did you fall in love with basketball?
As early as I can remember, as the story goes, by my mom. So I remember watching I think it was the 92 finals with the Bulls and the Blazers. And I guess just before that, and you know, it gets all hazy when you get down to like 3-4 years old. When I was 4, I think I started my Michael Jordan basketball card collection. Mm.
Have that collection today?
Still have that today. Some of them are pretty taken care of. I started going again during COVID when cards got hot again. Mm. And then I have a little card strategy I've been using every year now, which is fun because it's always, you know, it's kind of like buying stock in a player. You get their rookie cards, you go for the PSA 10 cards and stuff like that. Yeah. But I think that was it. And then I think Mike got me. You know, he's just so inspirationally good.
Yeah.
And so... He's so famous at the time.
Yeah,
so I think that was about it, 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah, Michael Jordan, man.
Yeah, he's the guy.
I didn't start playing until I was 11.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's crazy. I wish I would start. Like, where would my mind be?
Okay.
I watched that stuff, but I wasn't connected to it at all.
Until
I actually started playing, I didn't even know what sports were.
And you were out here?
Like 11. I lived in, grew up in like East LA-ish area, Cerritos, and moved out to the Orange County, then to Corona's where I really grew up.
Okay.
But that's where, and so when I moved to Corona when I was 11,
and
there was a hoop in the cul-de-sac in our street, and I just started playing 21 with the friends across the street, and it's my best friend, his older brother, showed me the AI cross and how to shoot over players with a broom, and then
I was
locked. You couldn't, it's been the love story ever since.
There we go.
Yeah.
The AI cross, that was a big one. Yeah, that took, you know, that was like, I remember that specifically because that movement wasn't something that you'd seen before.
Yeah.
That combination of movement, I mean, it's so common now, everyone can kind of do it, but I remember just being like, how is he making that?
Yeah.
How is he making his body do that and the ball do that? It was very cool.
Absolutely. So you fall in love at an early age. What were your influences in basketball early on and kind of get you going?
Michael Jordan. So I'm sitting there just like going through my basketball cards and looking at the stats. And I'm in Alaska, so we can only play for a couple months out of the year before it's snowy. So I had this hamper hoop that I modified by cutting the net and putting it up in my room. And so I'd be playing by myself and it would be like, you know, go downstairs, watch TV, watch basketball on TV, go upstairs, do all the same moves. I would say one of my the best things that happened to me for my current job was I wasn't playing on a 10-foot hoop. I wasn't playing with a big ball. So there was nothing I couldn't do. I remember watching Antoine Walker and Ron Mercer in the 97 Kentucky Final Four and then going upstairs and shooting curls on my little hamper hoop because Ron Mercer was like 100% on curls and shooting step backs. And you know, if you're at that point, I'm like 10, 11 years old, you can't shoot those shots on a 10-foot hoop that easily, especially back then when people weren't training as much when they were younger. So yeah, I think like, you know, that was a lot of it was doing that. And then I'd go to camps and stuff. But there wasn't a whole lot of basketball leagues or like, wasn't a whole lot of basketball people in Fairbanks, Alaska at the time. There was these brothers, the Hajdukovic brothers, who ran like the big summer camp, who were kind of the main basketball dudes. And they were great and they ran a nice camp. But it wasn't, you know, out here, it's just, this is the place to be for grassroots basketball. Right. It's easy to fall in love, but it's also easy to find mentors, role models, people to like be like, I want to play like that.
Yeah. So it's your imagination took you though
and
got you going on the hamper and I think that's what's missing. And you made a point to the smaller, the lower hoop and the smaller balls. Like, is that a point of your emphasis for you when you're training younger kids?
100%. I do my son's little preschool class. It's 3 to 5 year olds, which has been fun. Also challenging because like, you know, I have to learn how to communicate and deal with those little ones. And I just have the lowest of expectations, and we use the little ball, which is funny enough, it's harder to dribble because it's like, you know, hand-eye, it's like a smaller target for their hand. But we use the low hoop, and I think that's great for kids. I think just being able to see some success, being able to move around, once in a while having it being more challenging and like challenging how much power can I put behind the ball to get it up. But most kids are just so bad when they start when they're 3, 4, 5, 6 that to, you know, you don't like, I don't know, most of us don't like doing things we stink at. So you want to give them, you know, some confidence and some like, I can do this. You put the hoop down, you make the ball small, and all of a sudden they're like, I can make some shots.
Yeah, 100%. It's funny you say that. So my daughter is like, just hates getting stuff wrong. She's
of
just
course.
A perfectionist already, right?
Yeah,
so what I found her doing is that she practices those things when I'm not looking.
Yeah.
Or she thinks I'm not looking. Right. Yeah. So I like kind of like, okay, she's over there shooting on the hoop, holding her follow through. Like, I can't show her any attention. Because as soon as I say something, she curls up and starts throws the ball, like, because she doesn't want to make a mistake. And I'm trying to teach her. I ask her actually every day, hey, what mistake did you make today?
Yeah.
It's okay. Like, we all make, they're not really mistakes. We're just trying to get better.
There you go.
And teaching kids that, I think even kids, I also train a kid who's 14, about to, you know, playing some pretty high level basketball, and he gets upset when he misses shots in a workout session.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I just got done working out NBA player, and he missed more than you, and he didn't say anything. So you just need to get the shot up.
Yeah. Like,
how do you teach? How are you doing that, putting confidence in those younger kids?
So I'll start with the caveat or the disclaimer that I'm awful. I scream at myself like nobody. Like, there's no one that talks to me the way that I talk to myself when I shoot. It's probably the one place, one of the few places where I just don't feel like I have very much self-control. I've gotten better over the years for sure. But I struggle to not react to my misses. Even, and I feel like I'm a pretty good shooter at this point in my life. One, I think the basic idea of like, it's okay to feel the way you feel. You're supposed to feel that way because, you know, you'd like to make it. And that's good that you have that expectation of making it. At the same time, that feeling, the feeling of frustration, this actually helped me a lot, and I try to use it with other people. The feeling of the frustration that feels almost overwhelming is the feeling of your mind and your body figuring out how to complete the task.
Yeah.
And so anger is a anger is kind of something that takes the edge off of other feelings. So when you have that disappointment and that frustration, you use anger to kind of not have to feel that. So I'll just feel the anger instead. And so if you can, you know, give yourself a little bit of space and allow yourself to feel that frustration and that disappointment, you're allowing your body to solve the problem over long periods of time. And then if you do have that, you know, you're going to have an outburst here and there. Some kids more than others. Some kids not at all. And I'm like, you should probably get angry. He's like,
you hit that front. I need some kind of reaction.
If you hit that front rim one more time, we're all going to be sad, dude. Like, do not hit that front rim one more time. But, yeah, to give yourself the grace of like, okay, I know I'm going to get angry. I'm not going to have an outburst. I guess I stole this term from someone, I forget who. I would call it like vaccinating against failure. So like I have a visualization in my head of like what it's going to be like when I miss four of the same shot in a row and I'm like, oh my God, I'm sick. And because I've already kind of visualized what that's going to be like, that's within expectation now. That's not out of the question. And so, if that happens, you know, stuff that comes in within our expectations is a lot less jarring to our emotional equilibrium.
You have a degree in psychology?
Not at all.
Oh, man. This is good stuff.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Like, you study something here.
You know, I just study myself getting pissed off all the time.
Self-evaluation.
Yeah, trying for it. And then, you kind of have a better feel for it. And, you know, you let that one go. But my big thing is like, okay, you show some emotion, but can whatever drill we're in, whatever we're doing, if you show the emotion, can you do it without missing a beat and letting it affect your next thing?
That's it.
Because, you know, it would be great if you never winced and never showed anything, but I don't even know anybody, you know, that's never shown anything. Yeah. So, but can you be on the next play by the time it happens? And sometimes it's like that, and you don't have time to show anything. Sometimes you can show something, but, you know, the next play or the next ball is coming, and you got yourself, you know, ready again without... That I could you call it like the refractory period of like an anger outburst is like tightness and then so you have to get the before you have to perform the next skill. I talk with players about it a lot, and you know you have different players on different ends of the spectrum. You have people like I said that they don't react to anything, and I'm like, are you frustrated? And they'll be like. And I'm like, well, we need to find a way to get you
like,
to care.
Do you love basketball?
Yeah. Do you know you're missing them, right? You know you're beating the front of the rim up. And then there's some people that are just like, you can see that they've taken themselves out of it after three misses. And it's like, okay, we got to find the balance here.
Yeah. Man, I think that's good philosophy for life, you know? Like hidden, you know, something happening to us and having that refractory period as you're talking about. I think that's... It connected with me, just having that anger and then, all right, how can I get to the next thing fast enough and be emotional enough to be human, right? And not be a robot,
100%.
But also not overreacting and being the example more than anything as a parent right now. It's like, man, my daughter's watching me do everything. So when I react, and my son, when I react, she's learning that stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
And then as a coach and a trainer, it's the same thing. And so just relating that to life in general, man, I love basketball's, you know, way of teaching us about ourselves.
Very much so. It's a great learning tool, great tool for managing our emotions.
Yeah. So coming from Alaska, not a lot of basketball stuff out there. We have
not
some greats, Shane Battier's.
Some solid ones.
Mario Chalmers, right?
Those guys? Not Battier. Boozer.
Boozer, my bad. Carlos Boozer, okay.
Boozer, Chalmers, Langdon, who just got that Pistons job. And fired Monty Williams
that
today.
That was pretty quick, yeah.
Yeah, Monty Williams is going to get his money, though.
Yes, he is.
And, Chalmers was my year. He fried me in high school multiple occasions. He was really good in high school. He's like the number one point guard. I don't know. I haven't kept up with Alaska basketball. I never went back after I left. My whole family moved. But we had some pretty solid players at the top end. It's just you don't have the volume of players, so you don't have as many good ones. You know, per capita, maybe it's okay.
So what age did you leave Alaska and where did you move to?
I left at 17 for my senior year of high school. My whole family moved to Seattle, help out with my grandparents to the Seattle area. Great basketball area. Mm-hmm. Went to Redmond High School, Bellevue College, a little two-year school over there. And then I moved down to Cal State East Bay.
Nice.
And then after I finished at East Bay, I was going to try and play pro for a couple of years. Didn't work out. Ended up moving down here. And as soon as I moved here, a buddy of mine that invited me to come here and check it out, Charlie Torres. You may have met Charlie through the years. He does the same stuff that we do. I was just like, this is the place to be. I came down for Southern California summer basketball, and I was like, this is it right here.
Yeah.
like, and it was the lockout, so there was all sorts of good players playing all over the place, 2-3 good runs per day, and I was like, geez, this is great. So I just stayed.
Yeah. Working from, so you were there your whole childhood.
Yeah.
And you were good enough to still get college opportunities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What do you credit that to? Like, what not having those resources, like you said, you've been, we'll take Jared. You've been working with Jared since middle school, right? He's had somebody who's helped him through this process since 12, 13, something like that. You didn't have that necessarily, right?
Not as much,
not as much.
I had people along the way, but nobody, he had elite resources, elite resources. Not just me, but all the way along from Sacramento all the way through elite resources, the top of the top.
So what do you credit being having that opportunity to even play college
basketball? One, I mean, genetics, I'm a decently sized human being. Like, I'm not 5'6". Like, so, you know, I'm a pretty big person, pretty physically, like, strong person, like, decent bone structure, decent, like, physicality. I was really into Michael Jordan, obviously, and he probably wasn't the first person doing it, but he was definitely the most noticeable guy who was, like, people were talking about his work ethic and lifting weights and getting bigger and stronger. And so I was on the any jump program,
air alert, jump attack.
With Tim Grover, the strength shoes, Scam Central strength shoes.
Is that why your knees are jacked up too?
Probably, walking on my toes for years at a time. But so I was into that when I was 14, 15. And so that helped a lot. I played a ton. Like, you know, we didn't have AAU out there like that. I was organizing pickup games, getting shots up with my friends, like organizing early morning shooting sessions, playing as much as I could possibly play. Pretty decent. And then I played not a ton of sports, but, I played a lot of hockey. I was a better hockey player. I'm kind of built like a hockey player.
Yeah.
So I played a pretty competitive level of hockey. I think that really helped me understand quick decision making and, like, you know, hockey, soccer, lacrosse, basketball, they have their differences, but there are all those, like, triangle games where it's like one possession and then two or three receivers and then cutting around and then, you know, making decisions on how you get rid of the ball or how you attack into gaps based on the positioning of the other people. The thing with hockey is, like, one, you're moving super fast. Two, you have to be really physical a lot of the time. And then three, you have to get rid of the puck. Like, it's not like basketball where I can just hold it and just, I'm going to go. Like, you can, but they're going to take you out.
Right.
Like, it's not going to go well for you. So it's a lot of passing and moving and giving and going and like weaving and stuff like that. And I think that helped me. For the style that I needed to play to be effective at that time in basketball, you know, the early 2000s, that probably helped me a lot.
That's a very unique approach, like having that experience. I've never met anybody who had experience with hockey, right? Like, as their other primary sport.
You know who was really good at hockey was the Ware brothers. I've heard that they were like national level street hockey players.
Wow, that makes sense.
When they were middle school.
Big old dudes, man.
Big dudes, yeah, big strong dudes.
Yeah,
good players.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And then so moving to Seattle, having that college opportunity, what was your calling card in basketball?
It started shooting.
Yeah.
Shooting, I was a pretty smart player, like passing, but I wasn't like drive and dump off guy. I was like, if we ran flex, like I could throw it off your ear on the cuts and stuff like that. Like throwing back cut passes, like I was decent with the ball, but I wasn't like the elite wizard drive through the middle and throw it behind my head pass guy. I was like, I know the spacing, the hockey stuff. I know the spacing, I know the timing. I know where people are supposed to be. I hit people on time, on target, stuff like that. And then shooting, a lot of shooting, a lot of footwork, anything within two dribbles, a lot of threes. Basketball camps and then me.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I had these basketball cards, a lot of basketball cards. And I was really into all the players, and you know, everyone has their own unique little shot. And so, you know, when I'm in the room, in my little room, and it's cold and there's nothing to do, and this is before you had a lot of the entertainment, you know, modalities that we have now, you know, you're gonna shoot 10 free throws like Horace Grant, and then I'm gonna shoot 10 free throws like Penny Hardaway, and then I'm gonna shoot 10. So looking back on it, maybe this is me explaining it later, like variability really helps your understanding of how your body works and how to do a skill. So like I think I had a lot of variability in the way that I shot the ball.
Did you shoot like Shaq too?
I would try. Like, you know, you'd see and I'd track it and be like, how many out of 10? I'd probably miss a bunch, kind of like subconsciously on purpose. Yeah. So I'm like, Shaq sucks. But yeah, a little bit of that. Probably basketball camps and myself.
Oh, that's awesome.
I remember I made my first big jump was when I started shooting a lot of one-handed shots after this NBC camp in Auburn, Washington. And I started this shooting routine that I use a form of to this day, this one-hand shooting challenge thing that really worked for me and did well for me. And that was probably one of the biggest influences on my shooting and the form shooting sequences that I still use.
That's awesome. It's crazy how those things, like
having
a routine and then, like you said, figuring your body out, I think it's super
important.
I was working with a kid this morning.
Okay.
And kind of shoot, he positions the ball in the middle of his body.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm trying to get him squared up. He has a great shot, great touch on it. And maybe 2 months ago, like I really saw him getting here and kind of coming across.
Okay.
He's a shot maker. Like,
okay.
It's just a bucket. And I'm like, man, do I really have to change that?
Yeah.
Like, man, how his body is and the way he shoots it, said, let me just make sure he doesn't come across his face. His gather point, he's in the middle of his body because he's like 6'5", 6'4".
Okay.
Like, he's going to get that off. Why am I changing that? When before, it was, I remember when I first started training pros, it was like, no, we have to fix their shot. They can't shoot like that.
Oh, yeah.
All that kind of stuff with who I was working with. They wouldn't, like, that was the law. It's like, you have to fix their shot
or
they're not even going to get drafted. But you see so many different variations in body types and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, and you have all these shots that they've shot for all these years grooved into their kind of memory of how to shoot. I think that used to be, you know, kind of a big thing was like, we can fix your shot.
Yeah.
And now I get scared of the word fix. Like, if we try and fix things, I'm terrified of trying to fix people's shot. I'm going to try everything else before I do that, because if I try everything else, one, we're going to build like this relationship equity where like you can tell that I'm really trying to help you without ruining things.
Yeah.
It's not my way or the highway. It's like we're working on this together. And then two, if there comes a point, and there are points with some players where it's like, hey, we've got to do something here. This is not going well.
Yeah.
Like I've built that trust to like, okay, like I'm going to listen to you because you sat here and rebounded these balls off the front of the rim for me and tried X, Y, and Z. You know, constraints before we like were like, hey, we've got to move this here, and it has to be a conscious effort.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting. You talk about years ago when it used to be let's fix the shot, and now it's like, okay, what can we do to improve without taking too much away from what they already have?
I look at Tyrese Halliburton, right? Like, his shot was funky coming into the league.
Yeah.
And I actually know the person who first tried to fix his shot and didn't get
fixed. Oh no.
Yeah, and it's the person who told
was it ever broken though to have to fix?
There you go. And so I think he starts working with Drew Hanlon.
Okay.
2 years ago maybe, and Drew just improved what he had. Like you're talking about, like his shot physically looks the same, just has more arc and he has follow through and it's, you know, those types of things. It's like, like okay, maybe that's the actual recipe to fixing shots, because I coaches, especially ones who grew up where they were, you know, basketball shooting camps, like drilled out, you gotta shoot this way, gotta fix this, gotta fix that, and it's like, not all the time.
not at all.
Yeah,
and then to add to what you're saying, like, and I've learned this in the last few years even more, the shooting fixes, like, I don't even like the word fix, but you'll change your shot without subconsciously just by shooting a lot, because there'll be small things that you pick up on that you're not even aware that you're picking up on that are working. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of times, you know, if you have a good player, you know, who already has kind of their stuff dialed in, and then you don't see them for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, and they come back, and they're shooting it slightly differently than you remember, and you'll ask them, like, hey, you do anything with your shot? And they're like, no. But the ball is going in a little bit more, and they kind of made one of the adjustments that you'd been thinking about, but you didn't want to like mess with their shot at all because they were already a good shooter and things were going well. So I think that part of the shooting growth curve is underrated. The subconscious and unconscious adjustments that we make, you know, over time.
Yeah, it's a lot of shots to be good. The big part that you talked about too, at least with your shot, is that you were watching other people shoot.
Yeah,
could make the ball too. I don't know if kids do that now. Like, no. I always, like, I literally send every kid I work out with a video of Clay when he's in the Olympics a few years ago.
Okay.
And he's like 36, like, hey, watch him shoot. It is the same shot every single time. I'm not telling you shoot like Clay, but I'm telling you shoot like Clay.
Yeah.
Like,
there you go.
Do that. And like, even my shot has molded to look like Clay Thompson because I've watched that video so much. Like, I want to look like Clay when I shoot. That's just how I want to look. I
mean, nice looking shot.
I don't make it. It looks, kids tell me all the time, like, coach, you have the nice looking shot, but it never goes in.
Oh,
like,
no.
I don't get my reps up. That's all.
There
I
you go.
See, you're on the shooting machine still. I got to get back to that.
I try to shoot almost every day.
Yeah. I got to get back to that.
It's fun.
Your transition, so you went to a small college. What level was that college?
Just community college. It's in the NWAC, Washington, Oregon school. Ran around the perimeter, shot a lot of threes.
It worked.
Played a little bit of two, little bit of three, little bit of four because it's like small school and I could like bang with the guys down there a little bit. Nice. Had a really good coach out there, really enjoyed my time.
Awesome.
Learned a lot.
What was your recruitment like coming from a junior college and then moving to the next level?
None. no recruitment, none. Coming out of high school, I had like D3s around the area, like Puget Sound was probably the main one. There's a, what do you call it? There's a NAIA conference down the coast in Northern Oregon and Washington. Evergreen State College, Northwest College, a couple of those schools. But I wanted to move to Southern, to California. The girl I was dating at the time was going to Stanford, and she was an elite athlete. She was going to go to Harvard or Stanford and run track. And she was like, if I go to Stanford, can you meet me somewhere in the Bay Area? And I was like, well, I'll just hit some coaches and show up and try out. So I hit Cal State East Bay, told the guy I was gonna come out there and like play open gym, I don't know, April or so, the year before. Went out, played open gym, played really well, was in really good shape at the time. And he was like, yeah, I mean, it was Division III. So he was like, you can walk on. That's all there is at that level.
Yeah.
I wasn't one of like his guys, but he was like, you're good, definitely good enough to be on the team. So if you get into school and you're here, you know, you can be on the team.
Nice.
So then I was on the team.
Our motivations, man. The motivations that get us to
places. Right?
Yeah.
Hey, got me down here.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Right?
So after the Bay, after you graduated, you moved straight to Southern California?
Yeah, right right when I got to the Bay Area, 3 weeks, open gyms are going great. I'm thinking to myself, I'm about to start. I'm killing these dudes right now. But that's every college player the first couple of weeks. You're like, I'm killing.
Yes.
Thinking back, I'm like, what are you doing? You're just lower your expectations. But like 3 weeks in, I go to the coach's office and he wants me to meet somebody. And there's this kid sitting in the chair across from the coach. And he had this long brown hair. He looked like Jesus. And he was like, hi, this is Charlie. He was like, this is Charlie. He's going to be our point guard. And that's the Charlie Torres guy I was talking about. So I met Charlie there. Charlie did 2 months at school and never got to play a game because he got a pro deal in Mexico because Charlie's inspirationally good at basketball at that time. Charlie was playing in the Drew League at that time, averaging 20 points a game in the Drew League at 5'7", 135 pounds.
Oh.
Unbelievable skills, like,
dang,
like nutmeg you and catch it on the other side, shoot a layup off the pick and roll, nutmeg passes, off the elbow passes in the half court, like face up footwork threes, like
I'm sure
off
he's
the dribble
on
threes.
I can see this kid on
you
YouTube,
could probably find Charlie on YouTube in some old school. He used to play. Remember Keith Kloss?
Yeah,
he used to be on Keith Kloss Drew League team.
Okay.
Charlie was inspirationally good at basketball. Like, he was the first person, like, they tried to pick him up in practice, full court. He would just, like, immediately beat the guy, get him on his back. And, you know, this is like 2007, 2008. There wasn't that many guys doing the dribble hold, you know, jail dribble, whatever people call it now. All the way up the court, just could not get back in front of him. Like, unbelievable ball handler, shooter, just basketball player in general. So we would work out all the time. And so he really got me into how to create space and handle the ball.
You're being trained to be a trainer.
Yeah. He really got me into the footwork, ball handling. He was also a very good shooter, so like a lot of off the dribble shooting stuff. But yeah, that was kind of my pathway down here, because he left to play pro in Mexico, played for a little while, came back, was coaching at La Mirada High School with Derek Williams. Remember Derek? Yep. Arizona Derek. Number two pick in the draft. That was the year that Derek went to the NBA. It was the lockout year. So he invited me down to run workouts with Derek and check out the scene. And yeah, that was when I got down here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man.
It's good times.
What a dream.
Yeah. Yeah, basketball dream. It's great.
So yeah, so picking up, so that you were done with your basketball career at that point?
I was still trying to play. But I just wasn't consistent enough performer. I got too into, this is the classic white guy problem. People tell you you're not good enough at ball handling, and instead of being like, for sure, but that's not really what I do. I shoot the ball. And I'll get better at ball handling in the next 3, 4, 5 years or whatever, or slowly as I go, because that's my, I don't know, B skill, mm-hmm. C skill. But really, I shoot the ball. I got too into like, I'm going to be good with this ball, and I'm going to figure out. And I didn't have my identity locked in like I needed it locked in my moment to like, you know, you go to all these different tryouts, you get some different opportunities. They're not great opportunities, but there's something to get you that starter pack, that $600 a month in Estonia deal.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not the best by any means, but it's the deal that gets you going.
Yeah, if you're 22, 23.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't have it at the time. I didn't have it.
Go
like
back,
self-awareness.
Go back and talk to Shay of that 22-year-old Shay. What would you tell that person now, as knowing all you know?
Yeah.
I think it's on both sides, right? That's, you said, that's the white guy problem.
Yeah.
Said, hey, you don't have handles. And the black guy problem is, hey, you can't shoot. And so it's real.
100%.
It's stereotypical.
And there's everything in between.
It's not. Yes. And there's
everything in between.
Outliers, 100%.
Yeah.
But that is the stereotypical thing. What would you tell that young Shay now?
I wouldn't tell him anything because he wouldn't listen. No, I'm just kidding. no, I would say, you know, like your best skill is your shooting, and you have to have the self-awareness to understand that what people are going to value you for and what people are going to want you for is your ability to shoot and then your ability to create off of your shooting. And so, you know, handling the ball, being better with the ball, understanding how to do the pick and roll stuff, understanding how to create off the dribble. You know, don't stop working on that. But when you play, understand who you are and how you get your money. And that needs to be like 10 of 10 every time. You're going to die on that sword. Yeah. And yeah, I think, you know, not to bring Jared in here too often, that's been one of the things he's been best at and that I'm always most impressed at is like, you know, he gets a lot of that criticism, not athletic enough, not fast enough, not good enough with the ball. And then he goes out there and he's like, well, you're going to help and I'm going to shoot it and it's going to go in.
Yeah.
And then you're going to close out and then I'm going to go by you and shoot it and it's going to go in. And all of a sudden, you know, that's the way I needed to play back then. That 22, 23 year old me, that was what I needed to do.
That's
I didn't
awesome.
Need to prove that other stuff to anybody.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. No, I think a lot of kids need to hear that. It's a great speaking point. And even for parents, right? Because everybody
100%.
Wants their kids to be a point guard or to do this and to do that and to score. When if you look at even a college team, there's only two guys who are really scoring over 13 points a game.
Yeah.
Like not even talking about 20-point scores. It's not a lot. It's
barely any 20-point scores.
Your
almost none.
Your role and what you provide is what's most important. And that discussion with parents. And not to stop developing your other skills. I've seen... When Kawhi came into the league, he is not who he is today at all. He couldn't shoot. He was just a defender, you know, slasher, athletic dude. Now he's become, you know, a shooter. He has post finishes. He's developed into that because he stuck to what he needed to get to that point and then be developed after. And so knowing your role is extremely, extremely, extremely important.
It's the biggest. Self-awareness. Yeah. Self-awareness is like one of the major seeds of confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, knowing what you do out there.
Awesome. All right, so you're going to these runs now. Are you helping coach? Like, how did you step into the training side of the business?
So usually, because I was trying to play a little bit at the same time, it would be like I would get there early, get my warm up in, do a little bit of my own stuff, then jump in with Charlie, help out with, you know, he was running the workouts and I was assisting, like, you know, playing a little defense, rebounding, the, you know, the stuff that you do when you're assisting someone running the workouts. And then we were always big on a lot of playing one-on-one, three-on-three, five-on-five. So we'd run the workout for a while, and then we'd play, and then I would always jump in and play. And that was my role for the first, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months or so. A lot of that, a lot of playing. That was my favorite.
Yeah.
Still is.
Still is, right? Yeah, I still play these kids. Like, let's check up.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so when did this become a business for you, or when did this become your means of making income?
So not too long after that. So, you know, we had the lockout happened, extended summer. We're just driving around running workouts for, you know, pretty good players at the time, but then also running some workouts for just your regular high school kids, not too many youth kids at the time. And then we're also helping coach at La Mirada, because Charlie was an alumni and they didn't even have a head coach at the time, and we were bad. And so Open Gym Premier just took the space at American Sports Center that was, I think, designed for the move of the Sacramento Kings to Anaheim when they were talking about doing that back in the day.
Well, that didn't happen. Yeah.
OGP took the space. They had just downsized their business because they had like these, like they had like a whole big blow up, like where, you know, we're on the scene, a bunch of teams, and then kind of people left and took their teams with them. They consolidated, but they took that space as their home and they needed coaching. And, you know, after everyone started leaving, I'm like, this is really starting to slow down. What am I going to do? So I took a job at OGP coaching, you know, one of their 12U teams. And that gave me a spot to work out every day, a gun to shoot on, a place to hit the guys that were still around that were trying to get workouts in during the day and play pickup. Then I'd go to La Mirada, run practice, run workouts at La Mirada at night, play some more. And that was kind of my routine for a couple years until I kind of got the business going and got a feel for like the youth side of things. And, you know, the high school was being taken care of by La Mirada. And then in the summer, you know, some of the pro guys and the college guys would come back and, you know, been running some semblance of that ever since.
Wow. Man, it's crazy. You just rolled into it.
Yeah.
Stayed in the gym, kept working.
Yeah, exactly.
Things happen. I love the how genuine and how smooth it was, like that transition, right?
Yeah, I feel like I've been doing the exact same thing for a long, long time. It's just sometimes I get paid for it now.
Right.
Sometimes, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. And then, so I'm sure this whole you being a trainer, high school coaching, all this, it rolled into you having ABA Academy.
Yes. So, 2015, 2016, I met these ladies. I was doing some stuff at a Boys and Girls Club in Newport, and I met these ladies who, one of them was working at the Boys and Girls Club, and the other one was a friend of hers. They were trying to help me with my training business, because I just don't do well on the business operations, organization end of thing. I'm kind of more of a practitioner. I'm out there doing it.
Yep.
And so, you know, we talked about different forms that that could take. And even back then, we were talking about doing a prep school. But we were like, man, that seems like a big thing to bite off. Especially at that time, it was even a bigger thing because there wasn't that many of them. It was kind of before this boom of, you know, without making it a pejorative, fly-by-night pop-up prep schools. And so we actually just completely stole your idea and did it in Orange County. We were like, you know, if we're not going to do a prep school for high school kids because you need a bunch of money and you need the right education system because it has to be NCAA compliant and you need the good enough kids that it's not like, you know, what are we really doing out here? Why don't we just do a middle school? And at the time, I'm training Devin Askew quite a bit, and Jordy, his little brother, you know, he was looking for a place to go to school. They just moved down. And so we were like, well, why don't we, Dev was repeating eighth grade, Jordy was in like third grade, and we were like, why don't we use them as the test case, kind of help them through this year, talk to them about what they're going through with their whatever online curriculum they're using for one person being a holdback and one person being in grade, do the training, you know, and then we'll use our LAT as the learning experience and then next year launch. Nice. And that was kind of how the origin story of ABA.
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool. Sorry, dude, we stole thing. You'd have corporate
OC. No,
I'm just
no, no. So it's never stealing when you're helping kids. Man, yeah. I tell people all the time, it was cool. I thought, you know, I didn't hear about it actually until years later.
Okay.
I had no idea. And then it was right before Jaden Harper went there, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Because Jaden Harper was in CORE.
Okay.
But his mom worked in Orange County.
Yeah.
So next year he ended up going to ABA.
Got you.
Just a better fit for them.
And yeah.
That's when I heard about it. Like when I was like, oh, they have these other. I didn't know that they existed anywhere else.
Dude,
I thought I
was. You guys were the only one rolling. There was a couple people that were doing like little shops, but they weren't like.
It wasn't a branded.
It wasn't like yours where
school.
It was going.
Yeah.
Like you guys had it going. Like, you know, 25, 30 kids, good players, like organized, like going to be a year in, year out thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's. Crazy. That part is crazy. Duke, I started very similar. It was like, hey, okay. Johnny Juzang wants to homeschool and do training. Can you do that for him? I was training him at the time.
Okay.
His dad said that. I'm like, sure. I'm not doing anything during the day. And it literally was that homeschool style that first year.
Yeah.
And it was eight kids literally in a room like this.
Yeah.
Doing their homework and everything. And then that next year, I was like, okay, I'm not doing this homeschool thing. I was literally did everything.
Yeah, you were doing the most. I wasn't doing the school part.
You're
I had the
smart,
ladies doing the school
man.
Part. Because we're still like, you know, 25 kids in, you know, rooms like this doing the homeschool thing, but I couldn't do both. That'd be impossible.
You have teachers in there, like real teachers in there
doctoring
and assisting with everything. And I was like, yeah, I don't want any parts of this academic stuff.
Yeah.
And that was it. That one first year was our only year where it was like that. And then we did the traditional setting and partnered with the school and whatever. But I thought it was cool. I was like, okay, so this is, I felt like I was a little ahead of the curve.
Yeah, you were. You were for
Winter Circle did it apparently the same. We started the same year, but they did it with football.
Yeah.
And so that was there as well. But I didn't learn about them until literally 5 years after. I saw them on the news. And I'm like, hey, I'm doing the same thing.
Did you see them on the news and that one guy scammed everybody with the education services? Is that what you saw?
Yeah, that's what I saw.
Yeah, he got a lot of money for that.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. You guys watch out for these schools.
He was pitching us. He was pitching us. And
really?
Yeah, one of the ladies, I was probably for it because I'm not paying attention enough sometimes. And one of the ladies was like, nah, I got a bad feeling about him. And we went a different direction, and then, he took a lot of money.
Yeah, crazy. Parents, watch out for these prep schools.
Right.
Make sure there's real business people involved, not just sports people. That's my biggest advice, I think, is that make sure that those academics and you go look on the website yourself. Don't just trust anybody's word about what's being given for academics. I'm not against anybody helping kids get their education, being prepared for high school with any sport. I love it.
Yeah.
I hope this industry continues to grow and become more, just more and more professional at that level. Because I think this is the direction that basketball is moving in, is getting kids in a school environment with basketball like they do in Europe, where it's part of their day, part of their curriculum, so they're learning the right way. And so
I hope so. I hope so. I hope it can be more normalized and more, not regulated, but what's the right word? Just more organized.
Yes. It's the Wild Wild West, because anybody can pop up and rent a room and give homeschool academics and train people.
Yeah.
There needs to be, there's more to that. You need to really have people involved who are monitoring all of that.
For sure.
Accountability.
And honestly, it's not for everybody. We're not hitting 1,000% on everybody should come to this program because you're going to be successful in school on the back end. Some kids need to be in a real classroom, because once they hit high school, they're not there in the way that they need to be when they hit high school.
That's what happened with us, is that the social aspect of those first eight kids, when they hit high school, they started telling us, it was so weird going to class.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
so weird. Like, they didn't know how to operate around females, almost.
They
were, you know, just eight dudes in a room doing schoolwork, being boys and hooping. And so that transition, I was like, okay, we have to add that social aspect. We have to add that academic, that environment needs to be the same. And so that's why CORE went to that whole other route. And that's why we haven't even done, we won't do homeschool ever again.
Yeah.
just because of that, it's like, man, it needs to be a real environment because not everyone can fit that model.
No, not at all.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So transitioning into that training, things start growing for you, right?
Yeah.
You start getting players. You trained over how many NBA players now at this point?
I don't know. Like, if you count, like, you know, some one-offs and stuff, probably like 40 or so.
Nice. So you have a lot of experience with the pros, being on the court with them and making them better. Man, I always hats off to when you can develop an NBA player from the ground up. And when I say ground up, I always think middle school age, right?
Yeah.
So you've had that opportunity to do that. What's that journey been like for you to, like, did you already know it? And or did it just kind of naturally happen, like you're developing?
Well, actually, I mean, not quite middle school, but I almost did it twice. Okay. I met Stanley Johnson when he was like a freshman in high school.
Oh, man.
So that was one of the first people I was working with when I moved here.
In the morning at 6 a.m. every day? Yeah, that was you? I remember seeing it on
that was me and Stan.
Oh, wow.
So Stan was like too big to fail. I remember the first time I met Stan, I was talking to Coach McKnight. Me and Charlie were, and we were training Caden Reinhart and Elijah Brown. And Coach was like, can our center jump in the workout with you? And Stan's like peeking his head out, like, because he knows that someone's talking about him. He's trying to see what's going on down the court. And I look at him. And I'm thinking, like, this is the five. This is for sure, like, the senior football player, tight end, defensive end dude that plays center and just beats his head on people and rebounds. And he's going to throw him in with Kate and Elijah, who are, like, high-skill guards. Like, I mean, it's his gym. Like, I'm not going to say no, but dang, that stinks. And then I found out Stan was 14, and I was like, oh, God. He was just like 6'5", 225, man. Just so strong. And then, you know, we do some ball handling. He's like, boom, the Allen Iverson cross. And I'm like, oh, this guy's like really good. Like, who is this? And Charlie's like, Stanley Johnson. He's like probably one of the best freshmen in the country. And I was like, oh, okay, like, great. Great to have him here. So he was, you know, he was too big to fail. By the time he was a junior, like, you knew that he was going to go to the NBA. It was just a matter of, like, you know, was something unexpected going to happen.
Right.
Jared, very different story. So I met Jared through Stan, like kind of a long route of different people in the Bay Area when he was like 10 or 11, kind of like, you know, regular sized pudgy kid. Didn't start training him a bunch till he came to ABA for his eighth grade year. And when, you know, he was still a little bit on the bigger side, not fast, not athletic, very good skills, very coordinated, very poised, very much what you see Jared is today in terms of like the way that he approaches basketball and the way that he is on the court, of that focus and intensity and competitiveness. But geez, like, you know, we're doing layup drills and this guy's shooting like a one, I always make fun of him to this day. Like, dude, the first time I saw you take a lay, one, you smoked them all. And two, you shot them like jump shots from 1 foot away. Like, didn't have any of this for the most part, like, or like had it, but just wasn't consistent with it. But he, you know, talk about like just kind of up and to the right, slowly up and to the right, slowly up and to the right. By the middle of eighth grade, he had gotten himself into really good shape and was pretty chiseled and like really into like not only being physically stronger, but looking the part physically. Mm-hmm. And then in ninth grade, you know, I kind of, we all expected him, his family, everybody decided to go to Corona, kind of all expected him to play JV or just come off the bench, like ninth, 10th man on varsity, somewhere around that range. They had a couple guys leave and go to different schools, and so he ends up being the fifth starter. He's still not very high expectations outside of, you know, he's playing better than expected by a little bit. And then we were at the tournament in Vegas, that one at Gorman that have every year. What is that? The Tarkanian Classic.
Yeah, Tarkanian, yep.
And they're the 16 seed playing the 1 seed in the tournament, and he just went bananas. They didn't know that he could shoot like that, and he just had 7 threes in the first half. ended up with like 9 threes, and I think he had like 32. They win that game. They end up winning the tournament as the lowest seed. Had a phenomenal year as a freshman. And even after that, though, like, he just, you know, he was ranked in the top 25. Just to be, you know, he just doesn't look the part. He doesn't move the part as a freshman. And so you're like, you know, really good player, probably a high major college player.
Right.
Like, you know, we'll see what things look like as he grows into the NBA. Sophomore year, struggled a lot of the year. You know, was trying to figure out how to play with a lot of good players at that point. It was him, Kylan, and Donnie Dent, who were all, you know, Donnie's not in on a high major team, but Donnie's a high major player. He's like 18 a game at New Mexico.
It's killing it, man.
And then those two bigs, Devin transferred in. And so he was figuring out how, like, what his space was like. I should have taken more into this, but he had probably the worst workout that I've ever had with him at this. Do you remember that gym in Carson, the lab?
Yeah.
Awful gym.
Yeah.
Awful hoops. Volleyball court.
It's an indoor
bad
court.
Bad lines.
Man.
It is.
The kitchen towel floor. Yeah.
Kitchen towel floor. Jared drove 40 miles on the 91 from Corona to that gym to come there and brick off the front of the rim. I probably ran 2.5 miles after his balls. And, you know, he was going through the slump while he was playing, too. I think he had one really nice game against Hillcrest his sophomore year, and everything else was, like, just not the way he wanted to play. I was like, hey, man, how's everything going? Like, you know, what's your confidence like? How you feeling about hoops right now? And he's like, you know, I think I'm good. And I should have taken more into that. I don't know if there was enough to take into that, but that's been his thing is, like, very, very, very good at not overreacting to adversity and continuing to work in spite of, you know, the random results you get over in any short period of time when you're really working hard at something. You know, you can have a 2-week stretch where you're just awful, and he doesn't get flustered by that like other people do, I think. And so, you know, then sophomore year, they finish, they play well. Junior year, senior year, very, very, very good player. But even at October, his senior year, he was one of the best players at USA. And I'm talking to, like, some of the guys that do the draft stuff, and they're like, yeah, you know, really good player, loved him this week. 3-year, 4-year college player for sure. And I'm like, yep, you know, sounds about right. He's played, I love the way he played this week, shot the ball about as well as anybody in the mini camp, but you know, this is like probably not going to be a one and done player. I told him that. I was like, hey, your expectation is just ask Shire when you go on the visit. I didn't say this specifically. He came up with this question, but he asked him, like, I'm committing to you for 4 years. Are you going to commit to me for 4 years? I expect to be here for 4 years. So I don't even think he expected to be as good as he was. Or either that or he was faking it. but yeah, he just kind of, like I said, slow and steady, up and
just
to the right, over time, kept working at it, hit adversity his freshman year, kept working at it. And then, you know, I think a lot of it, back to the self-awareness thing, those first few big games he had, it was just catching and shooting one dribble pull-ups. It was the Jared McCain special. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, he had one game where he had 13 on 3 catch and shoot threes and 2 one dribble pull-ups. And, you know, it's not a phenomenal game, but 13 will get you some confidence, like in a, you know, playing for Duke. And then he had the Baylor game, and then after that it was more up and to the right.
Yeah.
So I would never say that I saw that coming, but it's always nice to be surprised.
Yeah, no, and it sounds like the consistency and the workout and the mindset were the two things that really separated him from the players that you probably dealt with, who probably had more talent than Jared, right? Like, raw ability.
Yeah, raw physical ability. Yeah. I'm starting to question whether or not that ability, like the self-awareness, all of that comes together as part of talent. Like, you know, that really creates your ceiling, because you can have all the raw ability in the world, but if you don't have all that stuff going on up here, like, you just can't squeeze the last little bit out of yourself that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, awesome stories, and thanks for sharing. We're running short on time. I want to get to our other stuff, but I want to,
for sure,
I really want to talk to you about just the mindset as a trainer, and what it takes to train pros. There's a lot of people trying to be where you're at. It's happened for you very naturally, right?
Very lucky.
There's things that are a part of you character-wise that excel above other people that have put you in this position to do that.
Yeah, maybe.
What from the outside looking in, right? You, like you said, self-awareness.
Yeah.
What are those characteristics that allow players to trust you with their process, and for you to continue to grow yourself to take them where they need to?
Yeah. So I think the thing that allows these players to trust you is for you to be the right amount of knowledgeable. Like, if you don't know anything, it's going to be hard for them to trust you, because, you know, pro players, even ones that are not on the top end of the basketball understanding and IQ distribution, are going to be far above, you know, most other people, especially like younger players. So understanding their game enough that, you know, they know that you can empathize with the way they feel on the court. And then I think you have to have, and this was really hard for me, this is my buddy Charlie's the best at it. I think it helps a lot to be human and disarming and like personable and relatable and kind of fun and funny a little bit and not too serious about what's going on. Like, you know, these are like the best in the world. Like, they have a lot of time where they have to be pretty serious about it. And there are times where, you know, they're gonna like really dig in and get busy during the training. But, you know, if we're in the layup warm up and I'm like, go harder, like, they're gonna get over that real fast, because they gotta show up so often that it's like, I can't have this guy on my head like this all the time. So being relatable, being disarming, I think that stuff really helps. And then I think just being really, well, two things to go with that. Being good, but to go with that is like knowing who you're going to connect with. Like, there's players that are not, like, I'm not for everybody. There's definitely pro players that are very good that I think I would like to work out with, that I'm sure if they came and worked out with me would be like, this is not for me. I do not like the way that he's going about it, or the style that he's using, or like the things that he's teaching me. I would like something else. And then, you know, finding your people, that niche of people that do resonate with you, and being able to identify those people quickly and be like, you know, connect with those people, I think is a big deal.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that's great advice for the trainers to
see
outside of all the skill stuff and, you know, systems and all the basketball part of it, right?
Yeah.
The connectivity and just the mindset stepping in on the court with those players. And that doesn't just apply to pros. That really applies to the kids.
Everybody.
Even more so.
Yeah.
You know, connecting with the young ones and being able to have a big impact on your life is having those things. So
very much so. I think those are general ideas that really help across the spectrum.
Absolutely. All right, so we're going to move to the next three segments of our show.
What do we got?
First one, we have my Rushmore.
Okay.
All right. So you were talking about high IQ passing.
I'm just going to do passers. It's my opinion, best passers of all time. And I'll do some honorable mentions that I felt like couldn't make the list. I think Teja Dosić is the best passer I've ever seen. I would love if somebody's watching this to send me better passers than this. I would love for somebody.
Who is that? Would be great.
Milos Teja Dosić.
For what team?
Played for the Clippers back in remember the behind the shoulder?
I do remember this guy.
Unbelievable. Yes. Looks like he probably smoked cigarettes at halftime. Like, just not that athletic. He's inspirationally good at passing. If you watch his highlights and his Euro stuff, he's like, he's phenomenal. Probably second best passer of all time. I get stuck between Luka Jokic and Magic and James Harden, and I can only pick three of those. And I really like Larry Bird too. I feel like he was an underrated passer.
Man, my list is so different.
Keep going. Had this those. He had that. Larry Bird had the widest variety of wild passes. Like, he would throw that one, and he would throw the behind the heads. And then James Harden is like just like unbelievable pick and roll stuff. But if I have to choose, I will say Luka, Jokic, and Magic. So my Mount Rushmore would be Teodosic, Luka, Jokic, Magic. Man. Best passers.
Very, very unique. And I like it. I see it. I like that because it's more. So mine here, I'm just telling you mine.
Yeah, that's why
you can see the difference. I got Rajon Rondo.
Okay, I like that.
His IQ, of his passes, I like his game. Jason Kidd.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised he's not on your list. I just feel like J. Kidd, because he had eyes in the back of his head.
Yeah.
That him, Magic, is on my list.
Yeah.
Just because he, not only was he efficient, it was like literally magic, the things that he was doing. I have to go watch this, Teodosic.
You got to see Teodosic.
My fourth, I have to go Steve Nash.
Steve. I love Steve, too.
Yeah, I think the simplicity, the soccer behind his passes, that part of it. Man, that's an awesome list. I'm going to go check out. Everybody
phenomenal.
Go check out Teodosic.
Phenomenal. Awesome. I like your list a lot. The thing I like about, Jokic is, unique to me because he does it from a different position than his traditional, which is a little more like Bird, but he passes more. You could argue you could take him off the list because he doesn't have the variety of passes that those guys have.
Right.
But I feel like
the
efficiency of his passing is extremely high.
Yeah.
But the thing I like about Luka is he's probably the best I've ever seen. One, the variety is there. Two, the shot passes. The way that he gets people to, it's like a video game. You know, like the players go into a certain animation when the player goes to shoot. Mm-hmm. He's the best I've ever seen at getting people out of position by looking like he's going to shoot. I would call it like gather pass and shot passes.
Yeah.
And then delivering balls like, I don't even know how he has the strength to be in that position and then get the ball back out with power. That's phenomenal to me.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I think his body of work isn't complete enough
for
me to give it to him. But I 100% understand. That's why
I
said I like how you're thinking about your best passers.
Yeah.
You know, versus mine is more of almost a flashy, creative, crafty type passers.
100%.
Good.
But check out Teodosic. Go watch these Teodosic passes. You'll be like, what the hell is going on? Because he's not that big either.
And I forgot. So I'm kicking somebody off my mound for Jason Williams.
Oh, flashiest passer of all time for sure.
Yeah, I guess that's, yeah.
The behind the back, the off the elbow pass in the game is still
legendary.
Yeah, one of one.
Yeah. All right, next part of the show. Fix the net. A misconception about you that you want to make straight.
Misconception about me that I want to make straight. Man, when you gave me that before, I had a good one. And then we talked about all this stuff. And now I lost it. Come back to that one. What was the other one? I think I had a good one for the other one.
Misconception about basketball then.
Okay, misconception about basketball. This is my favorite one. Positionless basketball does not mean everybody's a guard. Positionless basketball means that everybody knows how to play every position.
Yes.
And I think that in America specifically, we have missed on that. And we have that actually hurts our national basketball scene heavily in the way that we all think about it. In the people who are trying to be really good.
Yes.
That would be my misconception.
That is so true. And I think it didn't start like that. I think positionless was that everybody is a guard, right? This is when you have the stretch fours and people are stepping away, but it has turned into guards need to know how to post up. And you need to know how to play out of every single position.
They need to know how to screen. They need to know how to make those decisions. They need to know how to make those catches. Those catches are hard.
Yeah.
Those catches in those small spaces and knowing where people are coming from and how to get the ball back out. Yeah.
Dunker spot finishes. Like, that's my favorite. Like,
Drew Holiday.
Yes.
Drew Holiday showed us all how to be a positionless basketball player from the guard spot.
Yeah.
It was fire.
Yeah.
That was big
absolutely.
Time.
Him, Aaron Gordon does a great job too. He did it with Denver last year. He kind of did that same thing. He's all over the court doing
all
whatever
over
is
the court.
Needed. But yeah, absolutely. Do you remember yours now? Misconception about you? What do people say about you? You're a great trainer and you do everything right.
Oh, this was it. This was it. This was it. That I must really love basketball training. I'm not, I do the basketball training the best I can so that I can test all these things so that I can go play.
Wow.
I don't really love to do basketball training. It's fine. Like, I don't hate it or anything. Like sometimes I'll be like, man, I've been in this gym for a long time. I'm pretty tired. It's hot in here. But it's not like my favorite thing to do or anything. I really like to work on my game. I really like to play. I really like to work on the different parts of my body that need work. As I get older, they need more work. I really like to watch, you know, do clip search for the things that I want to clip search for. I'm not like, it's, yeah, like I said, I don't hate it, but it's not like, I don't love being in the gym for hours on end.
That is actually a new perspective I've heard from a trainer who trains at such a high level, actually. And that's cool. I think I love it because it's just something that you're good at.
Yeah.
You're just naturally good at, and it doesn't have to consume your life, though.
I don't think I'm naturally good at it. I think I work pretty hard at being good at it, and I think I'm interested in being good at it because, you know, I'm kind of locked into this. It's not like I can go get a computer science job next week if I'm like, I'm over it. So I'm kind of locked into this. So it's like, if I'm going to be here doing it and this is kind of what my career has to be, I should try and be as good as I possibly can be at it. But it's definitely not something where I'm like, I'm dying for this. I'm dying to get in there and train this dude. I enjoy being with some of the guys that I like being with, but that's, I mean, I enjoy also going to get food with them. Like, I don't need to be training them to enjoy them.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I like that. All right, man. Thanks for fixing
that. Yes, sir.
And our last segment of the show, two questions for me. You're the interviewer. I'm the interviewee. Two questions for me.
Two questions for you. What was your game like? How did you get your money when you were at your peak as a player?
Attacking the rim.
Attacking the rim.
This is attack. I had a 40 something in vertical.
Oh, you did?
I had crazy hops.
Oh, God, I'm jealous.
And I was a streaky shooter, though.
Okay.
I'm very, very streaky, but I would, that, and here, let me flip this. Defense. Let me start there. Defense is my calling card.
Gotcha.
I'll lock anybody up.
There you go.
Except for Tommy Mitchell, Phil Pressey Jr., and who else cooks me? Darius Garland.
Okay.
Those guys cook me.
Okay.
Tyrese Maxey a little bit, but I think I could lock you up, Tyrese. So I've guarded all those people. They all have cooked me. Anybody else, I'm pretty sure I can give you fits on the court defense.
Yeah.
Even to this day, like, my high schoolers can't score on me. Like, I just, that was my calling card. But my peak was, like, right after college. And I was still training. I was training to try to go overseas.
Yep.
I was working out for the G League.
Classic.
I was tip-top shape. All that good stuff. Man, I had crazy hops. And people think I'm a shooter, depending on what day they played. Now, I literally had some dude who walked into the barbershop the other day. He's like, yo, what's up, man? I ain't seen you in a while. Last time I saw you, dunked on me. You hit like 7 threes on our team. And he was talking about, I don't remember him.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, cool. So some people think I'm a shooter. I'm a streaky shooter at best. I hit 9 threes in a game before against some dudes.
Yeah.
That was, you know, so yeah, that's it. I think I'm an amazing passer. I see the game different.
Nice.
Like, just in my prime was, I want to say, like, Russell Westbrook, man. I was just, like, crazy, explosive.
Wow. You were downhill.
Oh, I've caught bodies, man.
There you go.
Yeah. I've caught bodies, though. Just downhill, crazy, explosive, super fast, throwing dimes, you know, that kind of thing. So that was my game.
Okay,
thanks
nice.
Thanks for that question.
Nice.
I never had that question.
No, that I always like to hear about people's games. It's always interesting to hear that and then see where they come from in basketball. It's cool. Yeah. And I got one more.
Mm-hmm.
Where, if you could, you know, as succinctly as possible, talk about kind of your basketball program and how you approach teaching basketball, maybe even just like your favorite things or the things you feel like you teach the best.
The things I teach the best. I'm an amazing communicator.
Okay.
So I don't think I teach any one specific thing amazing. I think I can teach everything to any level of player.
Okay.
I can just break it down to him because I took Chris Johnson's system. Right, he has a system that he trains in, him and Phil Handy. Like, it's a, you could pretty
much. Are
they
in the same system?
It is very, very similar. Very, very similar. They kind of developed it together.
Okay.
And they have their own.
Is there any way in one paragraph to explain that system?
There are spots on the court.
Okay.
There's attack spots in the key. There's perimeter spots that you attack from, and the decisions that you make have everything to do with getting to those spots and making decisions. And so everything you do in training has to do with making a decision from those spots. So we will never train outside of those you like, if you watch one of their sessions, it is everyone, it looks like everyone's doing the same thing, even though they're working on something different, if it makes sense. I don't know.
100%.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like I've come to very similar conclusions. I mean, there's very limited stuff going on in basketball. You know, you have the court size and you have the lines on the court, and you have, like, if you know anything, you know, about analytics, you know where the values are different, and you can quickly derive, like, okay, this spot is more valuable than that spot.
Yeah. That, and then footwork, having a good wide base,
and
being on balance for everything that you do, are, I think, are the things that I got from them. And then communicating. So I listened to Drew Hanlon for probably 5 years, just when he had his stuff online.
And, yeah.
Just listening to Drew. And so I feel like I communicate like Drew. I think he does a great job communicating what needs to happen. I use Chris's system. And I have, I guess, just my own personal touch is I care. I see the highest potential in any kid. Like, I will see a kid and I'm like, okay, you can get to college. Hey, you can be a pro. You could get to the NBA. Like, I look at a kid and really give them that encouragement and inspiration and make them believe in themselves. And sometimes it works for them, sometimes it doesn't. But for a moment in middle school, at least, every single one of those kids believes that they're going to play in college. And so their work ethic changes in a positive way. And so, I think those are the things that I do well.
Hell yeah, that's a good breakdown. I like that a lot.
Thanks, man. Man, this has been amazing. Wish we had more time.
Of
We're
going to
do this again.
We'll do it some other time.
Absolutely.
We'll keep
the
conversation rolling.
Thank you for being on the show.
Appreciate you having me, brother.
Shot clock. Really quick, tell people where to find you, or just an inspirational message for the listeners.
Find me on Instagram at shay.frazy. That's shayfrazy.com is my website. Inspirational message would be you go a lot further by trying to outlast other people than by trying to, you know, outwork them in a day or a week, or spend, you know, more time in any small period of time. Just push your timelines out as far as you can, and then commit to being consistent on that timeline.
Love it, man.
Hell yeah.
Thank you, man. That's all we have for you today. Thank you again to our sponsor, Scene, Max, Good Looking. We'll see you guys next time. Peace.